like to welcome three quarters of this four-man team, which would be Nick Gill. Sorry, that wasn't very geographically correct, was it, or anything? Nick Gill and Andy Burridge from Exeter and Deirdre Conlon from the University of Leeds. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for organising the sessions. What we've spoken about so far really is related to prison, and I'd start with just recognising all the work in carceral geography that's gone on to bring to the fore lots of other kinds of carceral spaces and institutions, including detention centres, hospitals, barracks, camps, ghettos, slums, schools. And what our paper does is takes an overview approach that tries to examine carcerality across a variety of different institutions. So we start with the diagnosis of carceral geography. While the fantasy of a separate carceral sphere, whereby carceral and non-carceral are neatly segregated, has been critiqued by geographers.
I did it.
Oh, you did it, okay. And others, it continues to overshadow the way that carceral spaces are studied, because a new way of understanding carceral systems holistically has not taken its place. So what we aim to do is to develop a new critical epistemology of the carceral via a meta-institutional geography of carceral spaces. And by this we mean not simply a geography above carceral institutions, but one that inquires beyond them, combining supra, sub, intra and extra institutional imaginaries and perspectives. And to do this, we take on the notion of circuitry. Circuits offer a critical perspective owing to the rich lineage of work within Marxism on resistance to capitalism and neoliberalism, which we see as driving the proliferation and diversification of carceral spaces. And we follow David Harvey's work. So it's related to circulation and also to mobility, which plugs us into different types of literature. But what we like about circuitry is this resistive potential of the notion. It's also inspired by Ian Cook's work on following the things that seeks to move past the awkward intellectual boxing up of social life if it's understood to be organised via discrete, containerised institutional imaginaries. So what this paper does is to provide a new way of critically apprehending the causes and consequences of the increasingly interconnected, more than institutional landscape of carceral spaces and practices that geographers and others have studied. We do this via a Marxist approach that exposes the real, material and lived circuits that compose carceral systems as a basis for a new analytical window onto the empirical reality of interconnection across, between, within and beyond carceral institutions.
Okay, so that's the why of carceral circuits. The next question is what? What are we talking about when we're talking about carceral circuits? And in thinking about our ontology, we're speaking to and speaking from ideas such as Jen Turner's call to attend to the relational, fluid, contradictory spaces of imprisonment. And also, as Nick mentioned, to Ian Cook's work on Follow the Thing. So I won't spend too much time on this because there are other things that we want to talk about today, but in our conceptualization of circuitry, we have focused on three central circuits: circuits of people, circuits of objects, and circuits of practices. And they are, I think, rather self-explanatory. So I'll just give one quick example to you this morning. That's circuits of practices. What we can see, or one of the things that we can see when we look at, for example, policies, is that they travel and transfer both across scale. For instance, the movement of policies around the supermax model of prisons in the United States is being moved to and winding its way into Latin American prisons, as Julie de Dardel's work indicates. We can also think not just about their movement across scales, but also movement from one space to another. By that we mean the movement from the penal system or the mainstream prison system to the immigration detention system. So what these kinds of movements, these kinds of policy transfers that we're talking about, or that we have seen and that research indicates, are either wholesale, sometimes they are adapted, sometimes they are morphed. But the reality is one where claims about the distinctiveness of these regimes is articulated, but the experience for an immigration detainee of being held in a prison, of being held in prison-like conditions, or of being thought of and conceptualized of as a prisoner, or as if they were a prisoner, blurs those distinctions. So that's the ontology that we're talking about.
So after the ontology comes the epistemology, or what we refer to in the paper, and I've got copies of the paper for after the session, as the epistemology, the analytics of circuitry. The first being return and recurrence. So a focus on circuitry points towards the importance of recurrence. And whilst that's already a theme in carceral scholarship, we argue that recurrence should be further explored by thinking in terms of the periodicity, frequency and pace of what we call carceral cycles, of sequences of loops and bodies. This prompts us to open a productive lens onto resistance, understood in terms of slowing or disrupting those cycles. And it is also related to return, which we understand in a dual way, both as return on profits, which is something that we see as driving this carceral proliferation and diversification, and also return understood in relation to the cyclical repetition and wastefulness of carceral systems, which is probably familiar to a lot of you. So we have in the paper six analytical takes on circuitry. The second is passing. Carceral sites are imagined as key passing places in various senses. Debate continues about their role in promulgating diseases, for instance. But understanding circuitry in terms of the route along which things pass directs our attention to two further aspects of passing. First, time pass, as described by Jeffrey, describes the shift in the nature of prison and other carceral institutions from reform or punishment towards simple warehousing. We see the calibration of the carceral landscape to accommodate this wastage as a hallmark of the neoliberal carceral landscape. Second, passing concerns deaths, euphemistically passing on in carceral space. In 2003, the Handbook of Death and Dying, a really jolly read, listed five causes of death in prison: natural causes, ill health or disease, suicide, execution or homicide. This list excludes deaths as a result of ill treatment, which is something that we are called by the Black Lives Matter movement, among others, to rectify. From 2006 to 2015, prisoner deaths increased 68% in the UK, and the chart shows deaths relating to restraint have been increasing. The third analytics is a component-like nature of carceral space. And this follows the work of people like Foucault, Wakant, and Peck that emphasize the relationship between systems of capitalism and neoliberalism, which are broader, and the components of prisons or carceral institutions. One might think of this in terms of broad systems of social risk and economic risk management. In this way, this way of thinking about carceral space plugs into broad logics in society related to security and profitability. In short, what this element of circuitry emphasizes is that incarceration is either believed to be, or is sold as if it were, capable of doing something other than simply incarcerating. That is, it has a broader social purpose for communities or economies. In the paper, we've discussed the various pitfalls and limitations of turning to incarceration to fulfill social and economic objectives. The fourth analytical take is compulsory meaning, which relates very closely to what Christoph was talking about. In certain types of circuits within liberal democratic contexts, the traditional association between punishment and immobility is being fundamentally reconfigured. For compliant prisoners, a mobilitarian ideology, following Christoph's work, is in operation that requires subjects to move along circuits that seek their reintegration into productive forms of employment and ways of being. For those that refuse this sort of circuitry, though, an auxiliary circuit of passing on from juvenile delinquent institutions to psychiatric hospitals to local community patrol boards, for example, exists. What emerges is a new fusion between mobility and forms of incarceration. Mobility has always acted in some capacity as a form of punishment. Think of transportation, that age-old sentence of transportation, for example. But this new fusion requires the active participation of the inmate. To be reformed is to circulate collectively.
And we propose that we can extend the framework and the toolkit to consider the ways that carceral spaces are circuitous, which is to say that they are oblique, obfuscated, obfuscating, often hidden from view. And examples of this kind of thing abound from, for example, the use of temporary holding facilities and makeshift cells, in courthouses, in airports, in at points of entry into and out of countries. And another example is the long history of the use of islands and remote places as prisons. The image here is one from Alison Mounts and her colleagues' work on the island detention project. And it is a project that exposes a number of sites, including this one, which is Christmas Island, which is part of Australia's detention state, where immigrant detainees are hidden offshore. It's not just a matter of hiding detainees or hiding them in offshore sites, but frequently these are extraterritorial spaces as well that in that process obfuscate sovereignty. So in the Australian case, sovereignty is extended to Pacific islands such as Manus and Nauru, while the sovereign status of those particular places becomes more ambiguous. Equally, and perhaps more significantly, certainly from our perspective, these sites produce legal ambiguities for detainees and prisoners as well, where the discretion of bureaucrats and petty sovereigns is not subject to scrutiny or public accountability, where the challenges of access for us as researchers, for legal representatives, for visitors, etc., are quite real, as Lauren Martin and Oliver Belcher's research indicates. But the other thing to note about obfuscation is that it is not just in these kinds of extraordinary spaces that we see obfuscation taking place. It's also in ordinary, everyday places where, for instance, the use of technology increasingly is used to track, monitor, and expand and extend carceral spaces that are actually hidden in plain sight. So one response that we have to all of this is to propose that as a counter-strategy we can implement critical mapping tools or critical mapping technologies that both expose and lay bare the circuitry, but also as a tool for resisting. And so I'm going to turn over to Andy.
Yeah. There's a table there. Sorry. Now I've made my grand entrance. So critical mapping offers a way to identify hidden connections in order to visualise them for collective scrutiny. It connects places that are typically encountered as discrete, but have been caught up in the same processes of marginalisation and exclusion. In the spirit of Sydney Katz's concept of counter-topographies, critical mapping of carceral security affords the production of new visions from the margins of and against the development of carceral circuits. Cindy Katz observes that topography as a traditional methodological tool in geography links physical locations of the same elevation. It is, in effect, a way to identify the hidden connections between seemingly discrete, isolated nodes. So applying Katz's framework to carceral circuits, critical counter-topographic mapping offers a way to explore the analytical connections between places confronted with similar forms of accumulation by dispossession. Critical mapping and locating projects can be deployed to not only support individual activist struggles against incarceration by being, quote, publicised to garner public attention, to advocate, to change policies and practice, and to support inmates in the immediate challenges that they face, and that's drawing on the work of Alison Mount, but also to place activists in solidarity with other struggles by tracing the contours and signature techniques of the neoliberal system that becomes embedded in different places in similar ways. We could certainly talk to these maps, we may be able to return to them, but I'll just quickly flip through. So the first was Trevor Pagelin's map on rendition flights in the US, where he's connecting rendition flights to find spaces of incarceration. The second is from Laura Kerrigan's project on million dollar blocks, which actually maps communities and the cost that is expended on incarcerating community members in what they call the city prison, the city prison migration sort of security. Some of you may know the group Migre Europe, which particularly looks at spaces of detention in Europe and its neighboring states and extraterritorial practices. And finally, another example being the work of Nancy Heimster, who is mapping what she calls the chaotic geographies of detention in the US and the connections of the transnational spaces then with deportation. So we're looking at the non-linear progression that detainees often face. And I'll hand you over to Nick.
So just to conclude in, I don't know, 0 seconds, what we hope that this paper does is emphasize, obviously, the connections beyond carceral institutions and the cross-cutting circulations that flow through, within, around, and between them. In addition to that, part of our agenda is to open up a series of new questions for us as geographers and as people working in the carceral domain. I won't go through each of the questions in detail here, but I think that they speak to some of the issues that folks have been talking about already this morning. What are the edges? What are the limits? How are lines between what is carceral and non-carceral drawn? Who are the actors involved in those spaces? And so on and so forth. As a review paper, I think you can probably appreciate that our goal has been to take stock of where carceral geography is. But more than this, our conceptualization of these carceral spaces vis-a-vis circuits, we hope enables both a depth and a breadth of understanding that we think is particularly important at this juncture where carceral spaces expand and extend in exponential ways.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I realise I'm the most hated person in the room with these cards, but we've done really well to keep the time. But so we've got some time for questions for Nick et al. Would anyone like to start with one? Christoph.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. I heard you about obfuscation, and I made the quick link with the Vatican we were talking about just earlier. And I was wondering if we could have evidences of the fact that prison was a really visible system which made a representation of justice and of punishment. And you mentioned the circuitry as a way of obfuscating, and also technologies as a way of making the punishment invisible. Could we, it's really an open question, but could we make the hypothesis that the technology is used to make invisible something that was visible without losing an eye on it? I mean, in a time of transparencies, couldn't technology be used to for the administration to have an exclusivity on the site, on the punishment, so hiding it except for itself? I don't know. It's just.
No, I think that there's just such a rich politics of visibility within the carceral system. I think that you are absolutely right. That within carceral institutions, it seems to be that the governors or the people that run the institutions are the ones that control the visibility. What's interesting, though, are the ways in which that sometimes troubled or sometimes usurped within institutions. So I don't know if you've heard of this concept of surveillance.
Yes,
it's kind of the opposite of surveillance. Mm-hmm. It's surveying the holders of power from the margins or from the people who are subjugated. And that's been very interesting. In fact, in some related work, we've used that kind of watching the, actually in my case, judges making decisions, and watching them very intently, and now feeding back to them about their inconsistencies and their ways of thinking, which has been quite powerful. Whether or not how it links to technology is an interesting question, which I don't have a ready answer for, I don't know.
Well, your question, your thought makes me think that what we need to be mindful of in talking about these circuits in any particular domain is that they are used differently depending on who the actors involved are, which speaks to your point about the significance of adaptation and the ways in which, you know, the penal system in our traditional understanding of it is unable to adapt, or perhaps, you know, there are questions about that. So it's kind of a methodological question, I think.
But the authorities don't have a monopoly over technology, right? No. That's what we're trying to, that's what we're trying to say with the council, I think. Is actually geographers and the geographic community has this ability to have the really kind of creative and innovative ways against the kind of proliferating neoliberal system of possible spaces.
Okay. Quick question? Yeah?
I really love this presentation, thank you. I had a question about, and I like this language of circuitry, and I wondered about it in relation to capillaries, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's obviously a connection there, and the Foucaultian notion of capillaries seems kind of similar, but it's a very much more embodied kind of metaphor. So what sort of, what is added by thinking in terms of the circuitry instead of the capillaries, and what's lost?
Yeah, that's a good question. So for me, capillaries is about power, I think, and kind of the microeconomies of power. I think there are a broader kind of institutional mechanisms at work as well alongside that. So I think Foucault is very much a pains to emphasise the kind of the micro. And I think circuitry also captures the kind of economic level and the societal level changes without excluding that attention to the interpersonal. So I would hope that circuitry is able to kind of point its way towards both kind of levels. I think that there are related metaphors like mobility and like assemblage as well, mm-hmm. in relation to this kind of work. What we really liked about circuitry is the link to David Harvey's work, because he's written about accumulation by dispossession, and what it really allows us to do is to plug into that kind of resistive potential, as I said in the presentation, so we really like that.
And I would encourage anyone to read the full version of the paper, because it really has got some really, really excellent nuances in there, I think, anyway. So it's at the front, I believe.
Yes, in the front.
I would like to extend out the conversation to all five speakers again, so you can perhaps stay where you are, because we've got Nick, Deirdre and Andy here, Amy and Ruth in the corner, Christoph in the middle, and Anna and Julie just here. So perhaps we could start with some questions for Anna and Julie, if people had them. I'm assuming you all did. I'm going to sit here and look at you all until some of them.
I've got a question. I was interested in, because you were talking about the speaking to prisoners as they come into prison, and I was wondering if you experienced any particular difficulties in terms of prisoners' emotion. I assume this is going to be quite an emotionally charged moment for them, and if you encountered that, how you deal with that in that context.
Yeah, definitely, I think so. Although we try and avoid to speak to them straight when they come in, so we do like observations of the kind of reception area and talk to people like informally, but do like the formal and longer interviews when they've been in a couple of days, just so that they have time to settle and actually, like, I don't know, get used a bit to the regime that's going on. There's also huge differences, I think, in terms of people coming in Norway and in the UK. So I think we do work with quite different approaches in the field just to kind of try and connect with people.
Also, huge differences in people coming into prison for the, obviously, for the 10th time or the first time. That will make a difference in how you experience that, probably. But I think in Norway, they are prepared because they, like we said, one of them ate tacos with his family the day before and flew up to the prison. So that might make it easier, but in a way it must also be very grueling to walk around waiting to serve your sentence and kind of have your whole life on hold for probably months and months before you serve it. So, yeah, but we keep talking about it and thinking about it because it is a potentially very difficult moment.
Thanks, Tom. Yes?
when you were describing or differentiating people you were interviewing, he differentiated that was male, female, and sex offender.
Mm-hmm.
Why the third category? Maybe I'm not familiar.
So, I think what we've been trying to do is not just the, I think a lot of the kind of studies that are out there are on mainstream male prisoners just because it's the biggest group, and we've tried to like include female prisoners and sex offenders as kind of subgroups. And I think the sex offender category particularly is quite interesting in speaking to them in particular sex offender prisons, but also in the kind of mainstream male state, which makes, I think, quite a huge difference to how they experience their imprisonment. So we've been trying to like keep in mind or be mindful of the different groups that are there and how they might experience imprisonment quite differently.
When you, for instance, interview males in a mainstream setting,
yeah.
Do you categorize them by their sentences as well, or is it just the sex?
well, it's a bit tricky in terms of, I think in some ways it's a bit arbitrary who we kind of run into and ask. We just talk to people on the landing, talk about the project, and just have chats and see who's interested. So it's kind of, it doesn't always, we don't screen people according to sentences, but we are mindful of the fact that some people, that we try and speak to people who've come in several times and other people who've maybe in for the first time, and also people who serve different lengths of sentences, and demand prisoners as well. So yeah, we try and keep a mix, but at the same time, it's a little bit on who wants to speak to us as well as
who
we want to
speak to. It doesn't matter with the mainstream prisoners what their sentence is. Sometimes it doesn't even come up in the interview, but of course it's also depending on the prison. Like in Bergen, for example, it would be people with longer, more serious convictions often because it's a closed prison, whereas in the prison just next door, it's oftentimes small drug offences. So. Yeah.
Okay. Wider thoughts for anybody else that had burning questions that they didn't get a chance to ask?
Can I ask one quick question? I really was interested in these different sensorial kind of depth, weight, tightness, breadth. And I was wondering there on the slide, you had depth. It seemed maybe it was describing it in terms of distance horizontally, but does this analytic also describe depth vertically, or how is that being conceived? I'm just curious about that concept.
I guess,
do you want to talk on it? Yeah, well, it's very explorative at the moment, to be honest. Like, it's developed by Ben Hu, but very on a very theoretical level, mostly. Mm-hmm. So I'm tempted to say, let's see what happens in the course of the research project and see how it's experienced. We're trying to capture it in different ways, for example, by asking how far from freedom people feel, or how, can you remember any more?
Yeah, I think it is just very much, I mean, it is about how, I guess you could conceptualize in a horizontal way, how people feel very much, I guess, buried in the system.
Yeah.
But also, we ask things like how thick do the walls feel, that kind of thing, where we try and like get the experiences of how far removed, basically, yeah, they feel from mainstream society.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, that's not very far removed, and in other cases, very much so, especially, I guess, in the high security state.
And that concept will probably be most relevant, but we don't know, but in the CSCs, we're going to the close supervision centers here in England and a high security prison in Norway, where we think that they might feel very far from freedom, but very deep, buried in the system. But it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, the back.
I'm just interested in a bit more, if you could say a bit more about the kind of comparative aspects of the works. You mentioned the sort of positionality at the start of your talk and about how had a kind of impact on what you're doing. So just if you could say at this stage a little bit more about how your own different kind of cultural backgrounds, how that's affecting the data collection process and how you go about doing things in different regions. That was an interesting debate that you have as a research team taking this kind of study forward.
Yeah, I think very much so. We've had long, long discussions with all the five of us, basically, on how we're going to compare and contrast, and very much on what certain words mean and how we can how we can tweak that. And it's very complex to try and get behind like cultural differences and language differences and so on. And I think it's taken up a lot more time than we thought initially it might do.
It's also very, very, it can both be quite obvious things, but also surprise, like I can never get over the sound of an English prison. The noises, they're just deafening. And in Norway, there's silence.
Yeah.
There's quiet, no one shouts. Like if someone shouts, something is going on. So little things like that, things we notice that I'm probably very blind to many of them. Like I said, I would never have really noticed that officer talked about power and how to avoid acting peace, but then pick up on that immediately, and probably also you. So that sometimes becomes very obvious that we're from different countries and backgrounds, and other times it feels like it doesn't. Yeah, that's an answer, yeah.
No,
thank you.
Yeah. I had a question for Christoph, who's busily typing. So I was quite interested. You've got mobilities, and they're good, and they're also bad. But immobility, you only theorise as something that's bad. Is there a discussion about things that are immobile but positive, and I just wondered if it was the fact that most words that describe immobility are verbs, so they're doing something, so they automatically translate into mobilities, waiting, standing, sitting. Mm-hmm. They're all doing words, so they become almost mobilities just by their very description.
Yes. We should have this reflection in French, maybe. Because
okay. I'm not going to help with that one.
The way we are talking about things can be different in different languages, so I'm not sure about this. But about positive and negative, for me, in my work, I try to keep away from this question of is it positive or negative. Mm-hmm. The question is, in these circumstances, do the people think it is positive or negative? For instance, at some times being immobile is a luxury. You can just go home and wait, and maybe wait for services and people to come around. It can be a luxury. It can also be a problem when you don't have work, you don't have money, and you're just at home because you have nothing to do, nowhere to go. So it's quite different. What's interesting for me is the value that we add to mobility and immobility, and then also the possibility for people to use this. Some people can be immobile and make people forget about their immobility. For instance, today, workless people are obliged to go on the road to find a job. Their immobility is a sin, it's a problem. But for people who just earn their money by taking cash, because they have houses, they rent them, and they have inherited them from their parents, this is also immobility, perfect immobility. But everybody seems to think that's okay. So this is very interesting. It's the values we attach, and I think we are in a trend to say that mobility is good, immobility is bad, but also that there are people able to use this ideology and people who are used by this ideology. Someone who takes two buses to go to a shit job won't be seen as a mobile, someone who lives a perfect life or so, but On the net, when I say I'm going to Birmingham for a congress, or I'm going to Boston, people say, "Oh, he's mobile. That's so great." But it's so easy because it's just fun, you know. And that's a question of using it, making it forget, or putting showing the immobility of someone to act on him, to oblige him to do something. So.
Okay. We are being cued by the Birmingham clock that it is 12 o'clock, just about. So I'm going to come to a close.